Les colloques du Collège de France.
Okay, cool. Hi, everyone. Thanks for all being here, and thanks for the organizers for an amazing event. I'm going to be talking about silly questions. I normally begin this talk by apologizing for my title. You might think there's a norm in academia that one's title should indicate the broad area that one's going to talk about, and given that many questions in many philosophical topics might strike one as silly, you might think I've flouted that norm. But luckily, Enrico and Manolo both mentioned silly questions yesterday, so, and I'm sure most people here are familiar with them. So these are kind of questions brought to philosophical attention by Ken Walton in Mimesis, as many things were. And they're kind of questions about the goings-on in works of fiction that strike us as strange or inappropriate in a kind of aesthetically significant way. In some sense, they're questions about the limits of our imaginative engagement with works of fiction. So I'll just give you some examples. So this is Othello. And the kind of classic example that Walton gives is, how on earth does Othello manage to speak such fine verse off the cuff in such distraught situations? Are we supposed to think that he's like some kind of literary genius? Also, he speaks in this kind of bizarrely poetic way in contexts where you might think it's a sign of madness that he would do so. So we've got this kind of question, like, why does he do this? How does he do this? And that's kind of silly and odd. Second example is The Last Supper. And Walton asks, why are they all sat on the same side of the table? It's like a really bizarre dining arrangement. Like, what reasons could they have possibly had for arranging themselves like this? Are we supposed to suspect that they were kind of scared of kicks under the table or bad breath of their fellow dining people? It's a bit weird. An example from Kathleen Stock, Tantan. Why does he never grow old? Why has no one ever noticed? Why does nobody ever comment on this condition? Is it a blessing or a curse? And obviously there's lots of other examples that can be given, right? So, you know, war films set in Germany, as many war films are, because they have a history. I live in Germany, I can say this. But you know, all the soldiers are speaking English at home. And you're like, what's going on? Are we supposed to imagine that the teaching of English was one of the highest priorities of education in the years leading up to the war? It's kind of bizarre. So all of these kind of questions are kind of striking. There's something weird about these questions, something inappropriate about asking them. And in Walton's discussion, he kind of introduces the technical notion of silliness to describe them. So there's a quote on the handout. Walton says, these are silly questions. They're pointless, inappropriate, out of order. To pursue or dwell on them would be not only irrelevant to appreciation, but distracting and destructive. The anomalies they point to are not to be taken seriously. Okay. So the idea is these are just bad questions. You shouldn't ask them. Asking them gets in the way of the real project of appreciating the relevant things, right? Kind of miss out on Othello if you kind of start wondering these questions about how he's managing to speak like this. And what I'm going to try and do is kind of focus on a particular kind of silliness. I don't actually think this is a uniform phenomenon. I think different cases get different kinds of explanations. And I'm going to try and isolate a particular kind of silliness and try and say something interesting about that. I'm just going to kind of mention quickly two strategies for dealing with these questions that Walton mentions. So these are strategies I'm going to call denial and de-emphasis. So the kind of question about Othello that I kind of indicated kind of assumes that Othello really does speak superb verse off the cuff in these situations. And you might think, that's not the case in the story, right? Shakespeare speaks fine verse. But we're not supposed to imagine that Othello utters the very words that Shakespeare puts in his mouth. Or think about the war film case. You're not supposed to imagine that all these German soldiers are speaking English. They're speaking German, it's just that the film's in English. So there's a kind of conflation of properties of the vehicle of representation and properties of the content of representation. If we go this way, then In effect, silly questions involve presupposition failures. Okay? Asking how does he manage to do this is kind of like asking why the chicken crossed the road in a context where the chicken didn't cross the road. Right? There's something, that question's defective because its presupposition fails. And in this case, you've got something similar. The questions presuppose that certain things are fictional and asks why. And then, you know, we've got cases of presupposition failure. So the questions are going to be defective and therefore inappropriate and whatever. And I think this is seems to me perfectly the right move to make in some cases. I think the war film case is like is a really plausible thing to say. I'm kind of skeptical about it applied across the board. So here's one reason for that. So this is Babe from the Babe films, some of the greatest films ever made. And you know, as you probably know, if you've seen these films, and if you haven't seen the films, you should make that a priority. You know, there's all these farmyard animals speaking to each other. And you might be like, well, what on earth has Farmer Hoggett been feeding the pigs and the cows, such that explains their literary, like, linguistic competences? It's kind of bizarre. And then you could make the same move, right? Look, it's not true in the story that they're speaking to each other. But then, what the hell is going on? What kind of cosmic coincidence explains the apparent coordinated behavior of these things? It's like, it's even more bizarre. So we started with one silly thing. We said presupposition failure, but then we left with other silliness, right? So we've pushed the silly bump around the carpet, or the bump around the silly carpet. I've not decided which way to express that. A second kind of case is, and this isn't kind of, it's just a something to note. Silliness isn't set in stone. What's silly can shift around. So, nice example of this. So you might have seen South Park. So in the first, you know, suppose you're watching the first season of South Park and you're asking yourself, why has nobody noticed that Kenny keeps dying at the end of every episode, but then has this messianic ability to be back the next episode? Like, that's weird. Why is nobody commenting on this kind of messianic tendency that the character has? That seems like a silly question, right? The thing is, in season 7 of South Park, they explain it. Kenny's mother's been cloning him, and there's this big thing going on. And I think a really natural thing to say there is, well, it used to be a silly question how this was happening, and now they've addressed this question, and, you know, it's not silly anymore. But if you go down the strategy we're thinking of, you have to say, it used to not be true in the story that he was kind of doing this, and now it is true in the story, right? Because we used to have presupposition failure, and now the presuppositions have changed. But that kind of prejudges certain questions about how fictionality over time works. And it's kind of surprising that you get this kind of, you have to say certain things about fictionality over time on this kind of thing. So, like I said, I think denial is the right strategy in some cases, but I don't think it's good across the board. The second strategy Walter mentions is like de-emphasis. He says the underlying fictional truths are, quote, not to be dwelt on or even noticed particularly. But there's lots of questions that aren't to be dwelt on or noticed particularly that aren't silly. So why is the character wearing a coat? You don't really reflect on that. But it's got an obvious answer. Fictionally, it's cold outside. Why doesn't the character float off into space? You don't notice, you don't think about that. It's kind of not something you dwell on. But it's got an obvious answer. Gravity works as usual. Okay, so lots of questions can be de-emphasized, but not necessarily silly. So I don't think like citing de-emphasis really helps us get a grip on the phenomenon. The cases that I want to kind of focus on relate to a kind of feature of most or a lot of examples of silly questions. And that's that they're explanatory questions. They're questions about how or why something happens, right? How does Othello manage to do this? Why does he do this, right? And in most of the cases, the questions involve some kind of how or why. And one way to see that that's important is if we contrast the how or why question with the weather question's not silly. We could ask ourselves, like, is it the case in the story that Othello's speaking like this? We're asking whether this thing is fictionally true. That's not a silly question. You can answer it one way or the other. depending on your view. But the why question is supposed to be silly. Okay, so there seems to be something important about the explanatory questions. And one thing to note here is that the explanatory question, if we ask in like a question like, why is it fictional that P, that question's got an ambiguity because of like where you put the scope of the operators, right? So there's one reading of the question where the question is, what's the Q such that it's fictional that P because Q, right? What's the explanation in the story of this thing? And then there's a narrow scoped reading, which is like, what's the Q such that it's fictional that P because Q? What's the fact that explains the fictionality of P, not in the story, but from the outside? And one striking thing is, the narrow versions of the questions have answers. There's really good answers for why the kind of stories have the representational features they do. Why do the German soldiers speak English at home? Because the film was made in Hollywood for an American audience who don't like subtitles. Okay? Why is Othello, why in The Last Supper are they all on one side of the table? So you can see all their faces. It'd be a really bizarre picture if, like, you know, Jesus's face was obscured because of, you know, seating arrangements. So there's like really obvious explanations in these cases. So there's something about the wide-scoped question that's silly. And one thing you might think is, well, the cases that we're thinking out plausibly involve a certain kind of incompleteness or explanatory gap. So you might think, look, there is no proposition such that it's fictional that P because of that proposition, right? There's no explanation given. Notice that's consistent with it being fictional that there's a proposition that explains it, right? But there is no proposition such that you can cite it as the thing that fictionally explains it. And one thing to note is, that's, even if that's true, explanatory gaps don't generate silliness by themselves. There are lots of cases of explanatory gaps where the corresponding questions are perfectly fine. So for instance, suppose you're watching a film, there's a character wearing blue socks, and you ask yourself, why is the character wearing blue socks? That's going to be a case of explanatory incompleteness, no explanations given of that, but it's perfectly fine to imagine the character's wearing blue socks because they like blue socks. A different example, take the question of, why was Deckard tense when doing the void camp test on Rachel? Okay, so this is in Blade Runner. And that question's not silly, even though there's no explanation that's given in the story of why he is. Indeed, you're supposed to ask that question, because one of the candidate answers is, he's really tense because on some level, he kind of thinks that if I did the test, maybe I'd fail and be revealed as non-human. Okay, so that's a kind of question of explanatory incompleteness where the corresponding explanatory question is central to understanding the aesthetic import of the film in question. So what I'm trying to isolate are cases that have the following form. I call them explanatory silliness. Cases where there's some proposition such that it's fictional, that proposition is the case. There's no proposition such that it's fictional that P because of that proposition. And the question of why it's fictional strikes as odd or inappropriate on the wide-scoped reading. Okay? Sorry, that is Deckard. I should have did that slide, but I forgot. So they're the cases I'm going to try and be interested in. To make headway, I'm going to kind of go back to an example, a puzzle about belief from Stalnaker's book, Inquiry. So this is William III. And on the way here, I was thinking this is a bit weird because I'm going to go to France and talk about wars with England and whatever. But it's Stalnaker's fault, not mine. So Stalnaker asked this question. He says, like, look, William III believed that England could avoid war with France. Okay, that's true. Then we ask ourselves, did he also believe that England could avoid nuclear war with France? And you're supposed to think there's something odd about that, because he didn't even have the concept of nuclear weapons, so how on earth would he have formulated thoughts about it or had beliefs about that thing? And the problem is that there's certain views about belief, for instance, the view Stalnaker likes, where you end up predicting that he does believe this thing. So this is the view I'm going to call belief as map. The view goes something like this. That's logical space. It's really small, but that's all of possibilities, right? And on kind of the way that we're thinking about this, what we do is we associate an agent or a subject with a belief state, a single state, that is somehow something like how they represent the world as being. Okay, and it's going to be like a subset of that region. Okay, and we say that a proposition is something that a subject believes if the proposition's true at every world that's in this state. And what we have is a case like this, because the proposition that England can avoid war entails that England can avoid nuclear war, and so the proposition that England can avoid nuclear war will be true at every world that's in his belief state, and that's a bad result. Okay, so over the other side. There's a kind of solution to this puzzle that Seth Yalshin gives in a 2018 paper that I really think is nice. So the way that Yalshin approaches this puzzle is he says, look, don't think of a belief state as just being drawn from any old set of worlds, right? What we should instead think is that a belief state is drawn from a kind of partition, a division of logical space into mutually exclusive and jointly exhaustive regions. So think of it like this. There's kind of like the divisions that a subject can make in logical space. Think of this as corresponding to the distinctions they can draw between possibilities. Okay? And now a... Sorry. Oh, God. Go back. Now a belief state is a subpartition. Right? And William can access the proposition that England can avoid war. Okay, that's going to be one of the subpartitions, corresponds to distinctions that he can draw. But the proposition that England can avoid nuclear war won't correspond to any subpartition. Right? And then the view goes that we shouldn't think that the mere fact that Q is entailed in this case shows that he believes it, because belief isn't closed under any old kind of logical consequence. It's closed under visible consequence. Okay? So there's a kind of natural way of thinking about this in terms of questions. So lots of people think of questions as partitions on logical space, and answers to the questions correspond to, well, complete answers correspond to the cells in that partition. So on this kind of picture, we're basically asking ourselves, like, where are we in logical space? And on Stolnacker's view, the answer, a complete answer to that, is a world, a complete specification of where you are. On this way of thinking, a complete answer is a cell, right? And the idea is, well, he can't ask any further questions because he can't draw any further distinctions, so he's done from a point of view of inquiry. So the motto is something like, belief maps questions to answers. And this idea is called belief is question sensitive. And you can see, hopefully, how that helps address the puzzle. Because there are going to be propositions that are inaccessible to an agent that he can't access because he can't cut logical space up in the right kind of way. And so if these propositions are kind of inaccessible to him, he's not going to be sensitive to the kind of questions. The question's going to be invisible to him. Okay? William III can't ask, should I use nuclear weapons? Because he doesn't have the right kind of concepts to ask that question. There's one kind of thing I just want to say about this. Here's a structure that can happen that's important. So suppose that an agent has a belief state that, you know, is sensitive to the question P, right? But suppose that the why question of why P is the case corresponds to a partition structure like this. This is a case where a subject will be sensitive to the whether question, but insensitive to the why question, because they can't cut logical space up in the right way to get the answers to the why question, even though they can get the answer to the whether question. And you can see the relationship with the silly questions thought at that point. So transpose this to the case of fictionality. And it's kind of, you have to kind of go a bit indirectly. So one thing I want to say is, if belief is question sensitive in this kind of way, then imagining or make-belief should be question sensitive in exactly the same way. One like very general reason for that is, if you think of make-belief as some kind of like offline or simulated analog to belief, then whatever structural features of belief are present should be replicated or simulated in the case of make-belief. Right, and this is kind of fits into a more general project that I've had. If you think, for instance, belief comes in degrees, you should think that make-belief comes in degrees. And if you think that beliefs question sensitive, you should think that make beliefs question sensitive too. Secondly, you know, consider the following case. Caesar imagined that there was nothing in his pocket. You might get distracted and think, well, how? Because Caesar didn't have pockets. But where did he put his keys? You might think Caesar didn't have keys, but then how did he get into his house? So it's a cause, right? So just go with the example. So he imagined there's nothing in his pocket, and ask yourself, did he also imagine that there was no iPhone in his pocket? And that seems to be just like the William case, right? How could he have imagined this if he doesn't have the right concepts, right? In general, if you lack the concepts, you're not going to be able to have any of the same kind of cognitive attitudes, whether it's belief, make belief, desire, or whatever. And this doesn't help by itself, right? Because if we compare the situation of William and Caesar to our situation with silly questions, it's very different. Because we can ask silly questions. Caesar can't ask the question about iPhones, right? William can't ask questions about nuclear weapons. But we can ask the kind of questions in the silly case. So you might think, it's not really helped. So here's the kind of idea. True, we can ask the questions. The questions are visible to us, and we are sensitive to them. But there could be norms that say that certain kinds of questions should be treated as invisible. Okay? So the thought goes something like this. There's lots of ways that questions can be set aside or bracketed, right? Or there could be norms to that effect, right? Think about terrible dating advice on YouTube of things like you should never ask a woman her age, or you should never ask a man a salary or whatever. Never ask somebody to referee a paper if they've recently been bereaved. Right? These are norms on questions. It kind of sets them aside for different kinds of reasons. And in the case of like visibility, there's a kind of script associated with this, kind of behavioral profile. So, you know, treating a question as visible or a question being visible involves distinguishing possible answers, being receptive to information that speaks to the question, etc. And the norms are basically saying, don't do that. Don't ask these questions. Don't distinguish answers to these questions. Don't try and get evidence that answers these questions. Don't whatever. Just set them completely aside. Treat the questions like the model that we have for William or Caesar in the other cases. So on this kind of idea, you're going to violate these kinds of norms simply by asking a question. You're going to violate the norm by asking the question, because asking the question involves distinguishing possible answers to the question, and the norms say, don't do that. So as soon as you ask the question, you violate the norm. Okay? So that's the kind of picture, right? Silly questions are screened off. They're norms associated with, like, saying, don't ask them. And are kind of given a kind of precise model for trying to think about that. Let me just kind of close quickly by saying a couple of things about a few features of this that I kind of like. So one thing is that it has this kind of structure. A subject can be sensitive to a whether question without being sensitive to a why question. And that's the structure we've got in the silliness case, right? We can ask, are they sat on the same side of the table? But the question of why is kind of screened off. So it has the right kind of structure in that sense. I'll just pick some of these for time's sake. Second thing I like about it is there's this bit in Walton where Walton has given us this like seemingly beautiful and simple theory of fictionality that, roughly speaking, a proposition's fictional if there's a prescription to imagine that proposition. And then there's all these qualifications where he starts saying, you should imagine it should the question arise, it very often being the case that the question shouldn't arise. And he never gives a precise account of exactly what's going on there. And I think what I've kind of gestured towards is a kind of step of making this kind of bit of Walton that I always find quite obscure, kind of more precise. This kind of approach really nicely accommodates the kind of temporal aspects of silliness that I kind of mentioned. You know, what was going on in the South Park case is that the creators of the show were recognizing that there was this norm and then changing it. And that can happen. So it used to be a silly question, now it's not, because the norms associated with our engagement with the fiction have changed. The norms are going to be conventional. And so one feature that you're going to get predicted is that distinctive aesthetic effects will happen when the norms are violated for artistic reasons. So here's an example. So in Star Trek, you might ask yourself the question, what has been going on in from an evolutionary point of view that explains why over time Klingons have become less humanoid? And obviously, from an external point of view, it's super simple, right? Like, we had really bad makeup back in the day and it's got better, right? But in the story, what's the explanation of the apparent change in how they look? And this is dealt with in Star Trek on different occasions. Sometimes they just reference it and make this kind of joke, and I think, I don't want to say anything wrong because I know Stacey like knows more about this example than I do because I don't watch Star Trek, but I think Worf says something like, oh, we don't talk about that. And then in a different one of the other Star Trek shows, they're like, try and give this long, complicated evolutionary explanation of it that everyone was like, that's terrible, and it's like, whatever. But it's like, they're taking this norm, and in the first case, recognizing it and doing something with it for an interesting aesthetic effect, and that's kind of predicted on this kind of account, I think. The norms are also going to be situation specific. There's no problem with talking about silly questions in the pub or after this talk, because the norms aren't operative in that kind of context. But they are seemingly operative in appreciative context, and there's good aesthetic reasons for the norms being there. Okay? And I'm just going to close with one thing, which I'm not sure what I think about. Okay? So I'm going to give you an example, and you can think about what your intuitions are. So it's fictional in The Hobbit that Bilbo never went to Mordor. And then we ask ourselves the question, is it also fictional in The Hobbit that Bilbo never quantum tunneled to Mordor? And some temporal sages of me think that that's like the William case. In some sense, I kind of sometimes think fictions are kind of like represented in a similar way to beliefs, right? Quantum possibilities are just not even in the vicinity of Lord of the Rings, and so they kind of like they get screened off in some kind of way. Like I said, I'm not sure about this. This is some I think this on like Tuesdays and Thursdays, and on other days I'm like, no, of course it is. Like, but like if you have the view that fictions represent in a similar way to maps or belief states, you get a way of articulating this phenomenon and accounting for it. And for instance, if you had Greg Curry's view of truth in fiction, this is exactly what you should say. Because Greg thinks that what's true in a story is what it's reasonable to attribute as a belief to some kind of implied narrator. But that's a belief, and so it's going to be question sensitive, and so you're going to get the same structure at the level of fictionality. I think you could get that result without the weird stuff about implied fictional authors, just by thinking of structural similarities between the way in which fictions represent and the way in which beliefs represent. But like I said, I'm not sure about that, what to think about that case. Sometimes I think they're analogous, sometimes I think they're not analogous. So I'll just leave it there. So I'm done, and now you can ask silly questions. Thank you.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.